Today's scripture reading really goes to the absolute core of what the spiritual path is all about. It's amazing to me, even after so many years, which are really not very many years. I started on the path when I was 18 years old. I'll be 59 this summer. I've been with Swamiji since 1969. You know, in the course of looking at one incarnation, those years stack up. If you stand back and think of millions of incarnations and eternity, it's hardly a blink. But in the little ego's life, it looms large. And yet, I am astonished by how many times, for instance, yesterday, the very fundamentals of the path all of a sudden are revealed to me in a way that I never actually understood before. And I've heard Swamiji speak when he was speaking of his years with Master when he was a young man. He was 22 years old when he met Yogananda for the first time and was initiated at their first meeting as a monk and a disciple. Yogananda lived 3.5 more years, and Swami Kriyananda was with him during all that time. But then the 60-some years of discipleship afterwards, Swamiji speaks now of how, even though he was very close with Master, he was too young to really understand how to relate to him. And he sees now as a mature disciple, if I could only go back. And then he reflects more philosophically and says, but one will always say that, because you're dealing with an infinite reality in the person or the consciousness of the guru. And until we ourselves embrace that infinity, we will periodically, repeatedly become conscious of the limitation of our understanding. That makes for humility and a great deal of receptivity, which are fundamental necessities on the spiritual path. Swamiji tells the story of how the first time he gave a public lecture, Master was in the habit then of speaking every so often at the churches in San Diego, the church in San Diego and the church in Hollywood, the self-realization churches. And for a long time, he hadn't been speaking publicly. And he had informed the members that they would put an announcement in the paper and they should look at the paper every week to see when he was coming. So Master was scheduled to speak at the San Diego church after a long absence, and the announcement was in the paper and everybody expected it. And then on Saturday, Master decided not to go but to send Kriyananda in his place. Kriyananda was 22 years old, had been on the path for less than a year. And he had to go down to San Diego, and he arrives at this church and the curtains are closed, and then the minister comes out and stands in front, and then the curtains open. And so there's Swami standing behind these curtains, knowing that everybody in the room expects to see Master when the door opens. And the curtains open, and he said there was a palpable gasp in the room, just like, because instead of their guru, there's this young boy, really a boy they've never seen. Swami was slender and very young looking. Swamiji said the room was absolutely jammed. People were standing looking in from the windows everywhere they had come to see Master, and instead they saw him. And he said all he could think of was, oh, the poor dears, you know, their disappointment. His concern for himself was completely obliterated by his concern for them. Afterwards, Master spoke to Swamiji about it. He said, and Master said, many people were very impressed with your humility. Swami thought, under the circumstances, sir, humility was not difficult. You know, because compared to the infinity of your consciousness, well, who am I? Now, that's a very pleasing attitude compared to the infinity of God, who am I? In fact, Swamiji says that humility is simply seeing things as they actually are. It's a very interesting statement, because often we think of humility as self-abasement. I'm a terrible person. I'm not any good. I recall a woman musician, whenever I would compliment her, she would tell me, oh no, I didn't play very well. Finally, in frustration, I said, what you're really doing is insulting my taste. I think you play well, and then you tell me, no, I didn't. I give you a compliment and you give me an insult. That's not humility. That's just egotism that just can't even be gracious to someone else. Such self-concern that you can't even be nice to me when I'm trying to be nice to you. True humility is just seeing things as they are, which is, even if you are the best violinist in the world, you're still just the best violinist in the world. This one little planet, this little mud ball spinning in space, one of billions of planets, probably with life on them. It's just a violin. What is it? Still, you might still be the best in the world, but it doesn't have to make you disproportionately move out of the truth of what life is. Now, we fight this battle on the spiritual path all the time, and this is what our reading is about today, between this deep longing for outward experiences. These are the branches of the tree being upside down, are all our nerves which go outward. Even when the little baby is born, the baby begins immediately to explore its world. It finds its own toes and its fingers and the shiny things in its bassinet, and it reaches out. And we just continue on that way the whole time because the branches of the tree go outward. Our nerves and our senses lead us into a relationship with our physical bodies and the world that we were born into. And the vast majority of people on the planet never advance from that. It's just a constant experience of either suffering or temporary happiness, or temporary suffering and temporary happiness. Master said that joy is just the interval between two pains, and pain is just the interval between two joys. It's just nothing ever remains as long as we're living in that world. Now, religions get very confused about the nature of that world, and true experience gets changed into dogma, and dogma doesn't really represent the true experience anymore. So there has been this very puritanical moral attitude, moralistic attitude toward religion, created in religion, in which certain things are right and certain things are wrong. And then we project upon God this same sort of stern way of looking at things. Do this, don't do that. This is right. This will get you in hell. This will be sin. This will be salvation. And we approach then our religious life in the same way that we approach the rest of life, which is we look outward and we try to sort of figure out how to make it work. Swamiji says the problem with saying that if you do certain things, these bad things will happen to you, you immediately want to know how bad will be the things that will happen to me, and how bad can I be and still get away with it. And you just start this whole calculation based on some system. The Judaism, when Jesus was born, had degenerated from a true mystical religion. It began as a true mystical religion, but it had degenerated into so many rules and laws that it was all just a matter of outwardly calculating. Now, on the face of it, and even for devotees who've been on the path a long time, you don't really want to be thinking of the whole world around you as something evil, or God as having created the world merely to tempt you. Such an image of God is extremely unpleasant, and thinking people will reject it. Very often people show up, more so a few years ago when people would come to us just to learn meditation because we were the only place in town that was teaching it. Now you can learn meditation so many places, we don't have this experience quite as much. But people would come with no spiritual inclination, but just a desire to learn to meditate. And our way of teaching meditation involved a relationship with God. And many people would protest, oh, I'm an atheist, I'm an agnostic. And my experience was that people hadn't so much rejected God per se, they had rejected some very bad ideas about God that had been given to them often as a child. That ideas that any heartful thinking person would reject. And so we would just agree to reject those ideas, but not to reject the concept if we could look at it from a new angle. Well, the difficulty is that we move through life according to the level of experience and what we actually know to be true. And no matter how many times a preacher can stand up and shout to you that something is sinful and will send you to hell, you might find it quite pleasurable, actually even really fun. And you might have a lot more fun with those who are going to hell than those who are not. I remember when I was still in school, still living in my parents' house, you know, just the most interesting people around were the bad girls. And the nice girls that my mother wanted to be friends with, I found them so boring at that time. And it was just the way it was. And no amount of reasoning with me would change what was actually my experience, which was that there was more in it for me doing things that my parents wished I wasn't doing. In fact, I jokingly would tell my friends that I am the kind of child my parents don't want me to run around with. I mean, compared to what young people do today, I was an angel. But in the context of my parents, there was a few years there where they weren't happy with my choice of friends. And I did get in a little trouble. It's not all, none of that is relevant. But it was a very real experience for me. And all of us today, I mean, a person can say, oh, human love is a delusion, or material success is a delusion, or having an IRA is a delusion, and sure doesn't feel like a delusion to us, does it? You know, the family just comes and goes. Well, it feels to us like the greatest value there is, the love of our children, the love for our children, the love our children offer to us, the companionship of a home, of a family and a lovely home. That is our experience, isn't it? So when we really want to talk about a kind of approach to spirituality that isn't just words, we have to go deeper into that. Now, it's very interesting. When Master was first coming to America, he had the idea for a book, which was the first book that he wrote and published and put out in America, and he called it The Science of Religion at that time. As it turns out, the ideas were Master's, but the writing of it was actually done by someone else, because at that time Master wasn't competent, didn't feel he was competent in English. So he had one of his disciples write the book for him. The book was written in a slightly pedantic manner, which didn't really reflect Master's consciousness. More recently, Swamiji rewrote that book because the ideas in it were so important. And he called it, God is for Everyone. Now, it's a very wonderful title, God is for Everyone, and the premise of the book is a very simple one. And it's the premise of the entire path of self-realization, and in fact, it's the entire premise of life, which is that everyone is seeking to experience bliss and to avoid suffering. And no matter how you look at it, no matter where you cut it up, no matter what human being you're looking at, no matter which aspect of your life you're looking at, that's really all it comes down to. We paste upon that, you know, complexities beyond imagination. But if you keep parsing it away, we act in the ways that we think will bring us happiness, and we try to avoid those things that will bring us pain. Now the problem is, and it's a very simple problem when you describe it this way, it's not always easy to discern. Partly because we don't have a consciousness that sees the past and the future. We're always living in the now, and we tend to think whatever the experience is now, that's what the experience will be. And when we live in just one incarnation, we just see this one life. We don't see what came before. We don't see what's coming after. It's very hard for us to believe that the moment will come. I'm going to be 59 this summer. I remember being 4. I remember being 6. How did I ever get here? Where did those years go? But one of the things that put me on the spiritual path so powerfully, I remember it very, very vividly. It was when I was 18 years old, in fact. I recall, my recollection of it is that I lay awake all night without sleeping. I probably have exaggerated that aspect of the memory. But I just remember lying on my back in bed, staring at the ceiling, using my imagination to move myself to every conceivable place in creation. You know, like other planets, or, you know, solar systems, or parts of the world, or just any place I could think of. And the first thing I realized is, wherever I went, I would be there. Do you know what I mean? That if I was able to look out and perceive it, that would mean that my inward consciousness would still be with me. I could not imagine a place, or a change that would obliterate me. Because if I could perceive it, I would be there. Then I was aware of the fact of the extraordinary solitude of that reality. And I had friends, I had people I loved, people who loved me. There was no like apparent loneliness in my circumstances. And yet, when one has the courage to look at it honestly, there is that extraordinary, inescapable solitude. And the moments in time, and I projected at that moment to the moment of my physical death, when it wouldn't make any difference if thousands of people were surrounding my deathbed. In that moment, it would be a solitary experience with me and my own consciousness. Now, being the person that I am, that was a profound experience that unalterably changed me. Because the difficulty with wanting to get our happiness from our family, our friends, our IRA, our children, whatever it might be, is a very, very simple one. We do not have control over those circumstances. No, maybe we're very, very fortunate. Maybe we have very, very good karma. Swamiji remarked once, he said, you see someone who has effortless success, who has a beautiful family and a job they love that brings them all the income they need, and children who are perfect, who came out of the children's catalog and they were the premium quality ones and all of that thing. He said, but you don't see all of the incarnations that went before that brought them to that point. You see them merely at the apex of who knows how many incarnations of effort and riding, as Swamiji says, that good karma. Swami made the remark, which is not entirely true, but there is truth in it, during a time when a lot of people were jumping on the Bash Kriyananda bandwagon, which sort of periodically comes around as the interval between the times when people are on the praise Kriyananda bandwagon. And he said, well, in many ways, he said, my enemies, my self-styled enemies, Swami would never calls anyone an enemy because it's not a definition he will accept. He calls them his self-styled enemies because that's how they call themselves. Swamiji once said, he said, I get so many brickbats, he said, I just really can't keep track of who is my friend and who is my enemy. So he said, so I just consider them all friends. That's how he put it. But part of his thinking, he said, was, he said, well, you know, those who persecute me, he said, in many ways they're doing me a greater favor because they're helping me to work out my bad karma, where all of you who are my friends are just helping me spend my good karma. It's a ridiculous comment, but in a certain sense there's truth in it, isn't there? Who is to say what is good and what is bad? But the end point of this is we look with envy often, or with jealousy, or with longing at lives that seem to go better than ours. And so we set ourselves up again to sort of try one more time to make that life work for us. And there's nothing wrong. It's not a sin to have a family. It's not a sin to have a beautiful home. Master himself lived in a moderate way. It's not the way of Master's path to be extreme. We're not ascetic in an extreme sense. It's simple living, is what Yogananda said. Master considered St. Francis to be his patron saint, but he said St. Francis worshipped, as he put it, Lady Poverty. He said, my lady is Lady Simplicity, which is slightly different. And in fact, simplicity also is not necessarily impoverishment of any kind. It simply means to have what you need and nothing more. You know, if one lives, if one has a profession or an art form or a lifestyle that requires a great deal, as Master said, if God gives more, accept it with gratitude. You don't have to reject it. But the simplicity of it is the simplicity of the mind, that I only have in my life that which I need and nothing more. Let me go back to where I was now. Oh, yes. But the difficulty comes in that once we say, once we live outwardly and set ourselves up into this reality where things need to be a certain way for us to experience happiness and avoid pain, we immediately make ourselves subject to forces which are totally beyond our control. And you can't pray God into doing it either. So often I read, and I mean, they're lovely stories. I get Guidepost magazines, and I enjoy Guidepost magazine. It's positive and it tells these wonderful, touching stories that much of the time bring tears to my eyes. But a lot of the stories are about how prayer works. You know, I prayed and my mother didn't die. I prayed and my dog came home. I prayed and I got that job. And it's not that God won't answer a prayer like that, but that's not the measure of God's love. That's just the measure of your good karma at that particular moment, or just a measure of your karma at that moment, and your need to have the feeling that you can control even God with the power of your prayer. It's a stage of understanding. But sooner or later, we have enough experience, and this whole story that I'm telling you in this whole long sermon is contained in the little story about the bird in the Festival of Light. God tells the bird to go out. Your mission is to be fruitful and multiply and share with all what you have. And he doesn't just mean be generous. He means have no self. Because the first stage is the rebellion, where the little bird says, God told me to do this, but I have a better idea. What else is wisdom except to keep what is mine for myself? Now, he's not talking about an egregiously selfish person. He's just saying, well, this relationship is mine, and this house is mine, and this money I earn is mine, and these talents are mine, and this praise is mine. Why not just attach it to the ego? Why not define myself by these external things? This last week, Swami made the statement. He said, people are just a bundle of self-definitions. He said, that's all, a bundle of false self-definitions, in fact. That's what the bird is keeping for himself. He's defining himself as his ego and all the things attached to it. And then, in the little story of the bird, we say, you know, the bird held on to this thought, even though repeatedly he lost everything he had. Now, that's what happens to us, isn't it? Repeatedly, we lose all this little bundle of self-definitions. If at no other place, we lose it at the point of death. Or we lose it because, darn it, people and the world just have a squirrely way of changing on us, don't they? You know, you just get everything just set. I mean, nowadays we're in a time of enormous change. And there was this very sweet man that we used to patronize his business on University Avenue. He developed film. David used to take a lot of pictures. We would take our slides down there. He would develop film. He had a little family, had a perfect little business. I mean, who would think that a film developing business would evaporate on you? But there it is. It evaporated on him. Just gone. I don't know what became of the man, but my heart went out to him because it was all lined up just so. And darn it, it just evaporated on him again. You know, this was me. This was mine. I get to keep it for myself, even though repeatedly he lost everything he had. So what happens next for the little bird? The little bird enters that stage of life, which is called the quest. He doesn't immediately enter the stage of knowledge. He enters the stage called the quest, where you say with humility and sincerity, what is really going on here? And all of us, after enough incarnations of just hitting the wall and crying and weeping and smashing and suffering, at least enter the stage where we ask, what is really going on here? Ever and again, through your awakened sons, the answer comes. And we begin to find the masters who have come to this world again and again with a different answer. Where is the source of power? Where is the place in this human life where I can really find happiness and avoid suffering? Within. The source of power is within. You have control over nothing except your own consciousness. And that's the whole spiritual path. There's no priests, there's no dogma, there's no theology, there's nothing. Master put it so just bluntly, the only place God can be experienced is in your own nervous system. That just is the strangest quote to me, because I just don't really think of the nervous system. It's just like, I don't know where to go with the nervous system. You know, oh, beloved nervous system. You know, you just can't think what that means. But what he's saying is that the human body has the capacity to perceive from within the human body. The consciousness can perceive infinity. A cockroach cannot. A puppy dog cannot. An elephant cannot, because the nervous system is not sophisticated enough for the consciousness to expand to infinity. We have a body. We evolve through different bodies according to the potential of our consciousness. And at a certain state of evolution, an animal body no longer serves our potential. We get a human body, which, by right practice of yoga, can be refined to the point where we can live within this body and simultaneously live in infinity. Absolutely everything that a true master has ever taught is simply and only that. Moses taught it, Krishna, Buddha, Rama, Ramakrishna, Yogananda, Jesus Christ, and all those yet to come and all those in the past that we no longer remember. They taught one thing and one thing only, which is how to refine the instrument to be able to perceive God. Now, on our spiritual path, that's what we're doing. And that's why Master put such supreme emphasis, and that's why Master defined his mission. I am here to teach you Kriya Yoga. The time for knowing God has come. Not just worshiping, not just praising, but going inside by the very specific method, working directly with that inner reality and transforming our awareness from a dependency on all this world around us, which will ever be in flux, to a perception of the inner reality which never changes. This is where we're going. This is where the quest leads us. This is what the masters have given us. Whether we take that or not is entirely up to us. The consequences of accepting it or not are entirely personal. There's no other reality. Wherever you are, you will be there. And wherever you are, what you will perceive will be the reflection of your own consciousness. Change your consciousness, and everything in life becomes everything you have dreamed of.